Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
Wir bei Vertex wissen, dass die Geschwindigkeit des globalen Handels zunimmt, was eine Steuerverwaltung komplexer macht. Und ihre unternehmenseigenen Systeme sind nicht dafür ausgelegt, diese Steuerkomplexität zu bewältigen. Hier setzen wir mit unserer Plattform an, die Continuous Compliance ermöglicht. So erhalten Sie mehr Transparenz, mehr Genauigkeit und mehr Vertrauen in Ihre Steuerdaten. Sie wollen mehr über Continuous Compliance erfahren? Dann besuchen Sie vertexinc.com/de.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report here on the BBC World Service. I'm Rahul Tannen. Plenty coming up in the programme. We're going to have a close look at the Chinese economy and...
Most countries do not have front of package nutrition labels, and many countries don't even have back of nutrition labels. And so that means that consumers have a tough time knowing what's healthy and what's not.
The UN has intervened with food labeling amid growing concerns about our health, and we'll be hearing why Prague plans to ban boozy nights.
We cannot regulate the companies that provide the services. Honestly, if they stop this business in Prague, nobody would have any remorse over that.
Remember, you can get in touch with us on WhatsApp or send us a voice note on any of the stories that you hear. It's 0044 330 678 3033. But we're going to start in Cuba, where at the moment there are lots of sounds like this. What you can hear there is a woman using a flashlight as she has no power in her house. And that is a challenge facing many households and businesses in Cuba. Marcos Antonio Rosello is a worker and a father.
We're going through complicated times. Every Cuban knows that. And I suppose the measures that have been taken are for our own good, but people are really feeling it. For example, I'm a worker, I'm working and I'm feeling it, and I have to provide heat for my little boy. It's hard for the little ones.
The situation has now got a lot worse. The Cuban government has declared an energy emergency after a massive power cut led to the failure of supplies across the entire country. Lazaro Guerrero is the General Director of Electricity at the Cuban Ministry of Energy and Mines.
Las 11 de la mañana, la termoeléctrica Antonio Guitera.
At 11 in the morning, the thermoelectric plant, which was generating approximately 210 megawatt at the time, went offline. We are reviewing the reasons for the shutdown. We currently do not have the cause, but when the unit went offline, the system collapsed. That is, it is at total zero from that hour. From then on, we are investigating the causes of the system failure, but the country was left without energy.
Let's bring in our Cuba and Central America correspondent, Will Grant, who joins us now from Mexico City. This, of course, Will, is a part of the world that you know very well. What are you hearing about the situation inside Cuba at the moment?
Well, I've been speaking to a lot of Cubans today in one form or another, particularly via WhatsApp, and they're just telling me that it, you know, what already looked like it was going to be a bit of a grim day with the announcement that state workers shouldn't come to work, that schools and universities were going to be closed down, that businesses should start to shutter, suddenly got very, very bad very quickly when energy emergency that you mentioned was announced. It was clear then that this was much bigger. And then once Cubans know that the Antonio Guterres power plant isn't in play, is essentially offline, they knew what they were already seeing before their eyes, that there was no power in their homes. And that was true the length and breadth of the island. And this isn't just happening overnight. This has been going on for some time, particularly in the provinces that have been dealing with days that might have 12, 14, 18 hours without without power. Generally, the Cuban government tries to make sure the lights are kept on in the capital, Havana, but now not even that has been possible.
Do we have any sense, and are you getting any sense, of how long the power could be out for?
Well, the president, Miguel Díaz-Canel, said that they were essentially working round the clock, that it was a priority to get the power back on, but he didn't put a time frame on that. And the truth of the matter is that he just doesn't know how long it will take. It could be a matter of hours. The sun is beginning to go down in Cuba about this time. And so people will be in darkness, I suspect, at least for a bit. And the difficulty isn't just the lack of light. It is the fact that there is fridges with valuable foodstuffs getting rapidly going off, freezers defrosting. There's no fans to keep away the mosquitoes at night or to cool apartments down with air conditioning. So people get very hot, very tetchy. You can't get water pumped to the taps in many buildings because they require electrical pumps. So when you take that all together, the fact that people are being told to stay away from their workplaces, they can't run their cars, obviously it's a very, very bleak outlook, at least for the time being.
Yeah, and this is a country that economically has been facing a bleak outlook for some time. Give us a sense for our listeners, you pop in and out of Cuba, don't you, of the economic challenges that people are facing at the moment.
Yeah, I go every few months to cover Cuba, and I used to live there for the past 10 years. I spent 7 of them in living in Cuba. So I know the situation very well, and as I say, I go often, and every time I go there, it feels like things are getting a little trickier, particularly in the provision of basic goods, particularly in the inflation creeping up, the fact that people are having to turn to the streets to get a better rate for the few dollars that they do get sent over every month from family members in Miami or elsewhere around the world. They're turning to the streets to try and turn that into usable currency in Cuba. So all of this is sort of pushing up inflation. Wages simply don't reflect the prices on the supermarket shelves. And it makes people feel very, very tired. If they feel like they've given much of their lives to being good revolutionaries, they've worked in the jobs that paid very little, but they got free healthcare and education as a benefit, they feel that currently I think the cost-benefit analysis is not in their favor as ordinary people. Many, many feel that way, which is why we're seeing an exodus to the tune of 1 million people over the last couple of years. That's, 10% of the island's population leaving every which way they can, ideally for many to the United States, but many to Spain as well.
We know that Cuba is a communist country, but it has been trying to develop a private sector. But as you said right at the beginning, these energy problems that we're seeing here now, they've been around for some time, so it's going to be difficult for that sector to function.
It is. The energy problems have been around for a long time. Of course, the centralized economy has been in place as a communist model, but so too is the U.S. economic embargo. And no discussion of the Cuban economy should fail to mention that. The Cuban government are always very, very quick to point at it as the problem. In this instance, they say it's the problem because they simply can't get the spare parts, the replacement parts they need for their energy infrastructure into the country. That is part of the problem, but so too is the fact that they simply cannot produce any longer in the main power plants enough for domestic consumption. They're not getting the oil shipments from Venezuela they used to rely on under Hugo Chavez, nowhere near the same amount, maybe a third of what they received in the early 2000s, and only half of what they received as recently as last year. And taking all of those things into account, plus the fact that, of course, now people do have perhaps more appliances in their homes. They're a little more affluent in terms of Cuban Americans coming home and bringing things. So consumption's up, production's down, and take all those things together, it makes for a very stressful experience for ordinary Cuban people.
Will, thank you so much for joining us. Will Grant, who spends quite a lot of time in Cuba, knows it very well. I want to bring in Chris Lowe from FHN Financial. Chris, what Will was talking about there, the problems that exist economically between the US and Cuba. We have at times seen the US maybe trying to move a little closer to Cuba, but those sanctions remain in place.
They do. And, there's several reasons for it. The last time we saw a thaw in Cuban-US relations was under President Obama. So, of course, that was quite a long time ago. And I think primarily it's because the opposition comes from the enormous number of Cubans who have moved to the U.S. and hope someday the government will fall and they can move back. They have huge influence politically, and in a sense, they probably should, since it's their country and not ours that's affected by the embargo.
Stay with us, Chris. We're going to head to your part of the world now, the U.S., where Democrat candidate Kamala Harris and the Republican candidate Donald Trump, of course, are going for the presidency. They are both out campaigning in Michigan, one of those crucial states at the moment where the polls seem to be indicating that there's not much to choose between them. Whilst they're doing that, the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget recently released an analysis of the campaign promises of both candidates for president and looked at the costs involved in their policies. Both Kamala Harris and Donald Trump's plans, they say, are likely to increase deficits and the national debt, though those of the former president, Donald Trump, could do so significantly more. Marketplace's Sabri Ben Archer has more on this.
Vice President Kamala Harris's campaign has promised to extend tax cuts for those making under $400,000 a year, have Medicare cover home care for the elderly, help with down payments for first-time homebuyers, among many other things. The debt price tag on all that?
Vice President Harris would add about $3.5 trillion to the debt.
That's over 10 years, and Mark Goldwein is Senior Vice President of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget.
And that's inclusive of their pay-fors and their tax increases.
Former President Donald Trump has promised to extend tax cuts up and down the income spectrum, lower the corporate income tax, and increase defense spending, to name a few items. Price tag there?
President Trump, on net, would add about $7.5 trillion to the debt.
The CRFB actually imagines several different worlds where things go better or worse for the budget.
And in that range, we found that Vice President Harris could be anywhere from deficit neutral to $8 trillion in the hole, whereas President Trump can be anywhere from $1.5 trillion to $15 trillion in the hole.
The Harris campaign sharply disagreed with the analysis and said it'll reduce deficits. The Trump campaign didn't respond to requests for comment, but in speeches, the former president has claimed the same. There are models that suggest Harris could reduce or freeze deficits, but no independent models that suggest Trump might. Harris would raise revenue through increasing the corporate tax rate, for example. Trump has pointed to tariffs as a way to raise money.
No, we've included the most revenue you could get from those.
Erica York is with the Tax Foundation and did the math.
That doesn't even offset the full cost of just making the 2017 tax cuts permanent. And Trump has identified several more tax cuts on top of that that he would like to pursue.
Neither party seems particularly concerned about deficits, but they should be, says Kimberly Clausing, professor of tax law at UCLA.
We're in a booming economy, but you never know when the next recession is coming. You never know what national security threats the United States might be subject to. And if you're already maxing out the credit card, then when something bad happens, you're not ready.
More immediately, interest on the debt is eating up more and more of the budget, says Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's.
The government's shelling out more on interest than they are on the defense budget for the first time in history.
Deficits can also eventually start to push buttons in the economy that you really do not want pushed because they end up limiting economic growth.
Higher deficits and debt become a problem when they lead to higher interest rates.
Suddenly, injecting more money into the economy can cause inflation, says Mark Goldwein, which can force the Fed to raise interest rates.
But then instead of inflation, what you have is a higher mortgage rate and a higher rate on your car loan.
Plus, if the government sells more and more bonds to pay for its spending, somebody has to buy those.
If there's so much debt, if there's a lot of bonds out there that need to be purchased, those people who are buying it begin to say, hey, look, are you going to be able to pay me back? They begin to question it and they say, you got to pay me in higher rate of interest to compensate for the risk that you might not.
In other countries, that's led to a spiral where the debt gets so big, investors don't want to lend. So rates go up and the debt gets even bigger and investors want to lend even less. That is what you call a debt crisis. And Zandi says a crisis is what it may take to get politicians to take deficits more seriously.
Let us see if they do that. Chris Lowe still with us. And we just had some figures in the last couple of hours. U.S. Post, $1.8 trillion annual deficit, highest outside of COVID, and it doesn't really seem that either of the candidates is going to tackle that problem.
No, I don't get that sense from not only the candidates for president, but also most of the candidates for Congress. And I think that is an essential element to consider here, because any of the tax or spending programs proposed by these two candidates would have to pass Congress. And that's been a particularly contentious place lately, and it can lead to unexpected outcomes. For example, President Biden was talking about a more responsible budget when he took office. He was able to get many of his spending programs through, but he was not able to pass any of the tax increases he wanted. The result, of course, were those numbers, that $1.8 trillion deficit you just mentioned.
We were talking there about debt in the world's largest economy. Let's move to the world's second largest economy that is having a tough time. On Friday, its official statistical agency in China announced that its GDP rose by 4.6% between July and September on an annual basis. This was the slowest pace since early last year, but officials were upbeat about future growth.
We can also see the trend of steady economic recovery and positive changes from some leading indicators. For example, electricity consumption data and changes in prices of some means of production in early October and consumption data from the National Day Golden Week holiday all indicate that it's highly likely that the economy will stabilize and pick up in the fourth quarter.
Mayor of China's National Bureau of Statistics. Let's bring in Sarah Xu, who is from the University of Tennessee and knows China very well. She joins us from Knoxville. Sarah, thanks again for joining us on the program. We continually talk about these problems that China's facing. What is it that's causing most of these problems at the moment?
Well, it's the same things that have been going on for the past 10 years or so seem to be worsening. First of all, there's the property sector downturn, which China still hasn't recovered from. There is weak domestic demand. And now we see deflation happening, which is exacerbating conditions all around.
It is, isn't it? The government's trying to stimulate the economy, but how are they going to get people spending again? Because they seem reluctant to do so.
Well, it's a really difficult situation. So stimulus is good when you have an economy that's fully functioning and that is working well. People are employed. There are people who are purchasing the goods and services that are being produced. That's not exactly happening in China. So China is dealing with high youth unemployment still and weak productivity growth and low consumption. So stimulus really only goes so far if people don't have a job and if companies are not really able to produce in an efficient way.
You're saying it can only go so far. Final question to you. Do you think, though, that the Chinese government will put more stimulus into the economy?
I think so. If history shows us anything, it shows us that China knows how to stimulate the economy. Things are not going so well in terms of stimulating it. The returns are slowing down. But I'm sure that more will be done for real estate, more will be done to boost local governments and so on.
Sarah, thanks so much for joining us on the program. Chris, even though those figures didn't come in as expected, the Chinese stock market's on a bit of a tear at the moment.
It is. And it is partly because we had monthly numbers. These were September numbers, so end of third quarter. And the suggestion is that the economy is beginning to gain some momentum, enough so that economists on the ground believe that growth could accelerate to 5% by the end of the year, which, of course, is the official target. I think more important to those equity investors, though, is the fact that the economy seems to be coming out of the hole, which means returns should improve.
Well, let us see if that is.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast, and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
is the case. You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. The global food industry, it's growing rapidly. Some estimates say it's now worth more than $10 trillion. But there are growing concerns about how healthy some of the food that we consume actually is. So now the United Nations has stepped in. Lindsay Smith-Tully is the co-director of the Global Food Research Program at the University of North Carolina. And she's been telling me about what they want global food producers to now do.
What they're recommending is that we need clear and easy to understand labels on the front of food packages to make it easier for consumers to know what foods are healthy. And that's a pretty big deal because that is something that has not happened before globally. Most countries do not have front of package nutrition labels, and many countries don't even have back of nutrition labels. And so that means that consumers have a tough time knowing what's healthy and what's not.
That raises an interesting point because there are more and more concerns, aren't there, about what we're eating, how healthy it is, how much sugar, how much salt is in there. So why aren't we seeing these labelings in many parts of the world? Is it the food companies themselves who don't want to put it on?
So it really depends on the country. When we're thinking about countries like the United States or other high-income countries, one of the major challenges has been that the food lobby is very strong. And also we have very strong protections around corporate free speech. Mandatory food labels are actually requiring companies to say something that they may not want to say if their foods are unhealthy. And that's why the food lobby has really come out very strongly against these types of front of package labels.
You're somebody who looks at this very closely. You've also been looking at Chile, which is really a world leader in this area. Tell us what they do and how that's working.
So Chile was the first country in the world to require a mandatory system of front of package warning labels. And this is a very unique kind of label because it's not just a number or a color. It is a big, bold black stop sign that really stands out from the package and tells consumers when a food is high in sugar, saturated fat, sodium, or calories. And what we found is that this policy has been really effective at both changing how the food industry works. So the food industry has actually cut the amount of sugar, sodium, and saturated fat in their products because they want to avoid these labels. And it's also been really effective for consumers. We found that people really understand what this means. Even young children understand what these clear labels mean, and that this has led people to purchase fewer products that are high in these nutrients of concern.
The World Health Organization is proposing this, but I suppose it's going to come down to individual governments to get tougher with some of these food companies, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And one thing that the World Health Organization did not do, which I wish they would have, they didn't distinguish that these labels should be mandatory, that they should be government-led. And that's something that's really important because what we've seen in the U.S. and in many countries around the world is that when food companies are allowed to create their own voluntary labels, that they'll often use labels that are harder for consumers to understand.
You look at this very closely. When you look at it globally, what sort of percentage of countries are actually looking at this closely now and are putting laws in place, forcing food producers to tell us what we're eating, what's in there?
If you look at a map of the globe, what you'll see is that most of the Americas are already covered with these kinds of labels. This policy started in Chile, and then it spread through most of South America, and now Mexico and Canada have these kind of labels as well. The United States is an outlier, but we have most of the Americas with these labels, and now we're seeing that this policy is really proliferating globally. So South Africa is currently considering a similar proposition. There are other countries in Africa, and then countries in Asia as well. We have India, Indonesia, Bangladesh, Thailand, all of these countries are really very actively considering a similar type of label. So I would say this is spreading rather quickly.
Chris, interesting to hear from Lindsay there. And this is going to be a big challenge for a lot of global food companies, isn't it? We want more information about what's in the products that we're buying.
It is going to be a challenge. But, you know, there's other economic benefits that could come from this as well when you consider that the enormous healthcare costs to societies when consumers don't know what they're eating and end up with obesity and other issues like diabetes that come with eating the wrong foods.
Yeah, good point there on the economic problems of obesity and what they are creating for society. Now, Prague, the capital of the Czech Republic, is a popular party destination for tourists. And they're now, though, going to ban late-night bar crawls from next month. Over the past decades, partly thanks to a boom in budget airlines, Prague has become a go-to destination for bachelor and bachelorette parties. I've been speaking with Adam Zabransky from Prague City Council and asked, why do you want to impose such a ban?
Well, the problem is that these groups of tens of people who are traveling throughout the night from one pub to another, when they are drunk, which they are, they make a lot of noise and a lot of pollution in the streets. So people living around the streets where the pub crawling pubs are concentrated in really cannot sleep. So it's a really big problem. We cannot regulate the companies that provide the services. Honestly, if they stopped this business in Prague, nobody would have any remorse over that. So we do not ban people from drinking in Prague, but what we do not want is for them, while being drunk, yelling in the streets throughout the night.
How do you stop people going from one pub to another pub if you're not going to take action against the companies who are organizing it?
What we banned is the guiding. So when there is a group of people going from one pub to another in the night and the police is there, which they often are, they will give a fine to the guide that is guiding these people. We are not banning a group of friends from, you know, traveling through the streets. What we banned is guiding services.
What sort of fines will they face now?
It's up to British pounds. It would be something around £4,000 at the most.
Okay, so that's a pretty significant fine. Prague has become very popular, hasn't it, for many people to go to. It's also popular for these hen and stag do's that people have. Are you worried that by putting this in place, you could affect that industry?
We like people coming to Prague. We support tourism. But what we would like to see more is a true tourism where people come here to see the beauty of Prague and spend a few days here and not just to come here to be drunk 2 days straight and then going back to their country. We are trying to invite a different group of tourists, and we hope that this measure will support what we are trying to do here.
Clearly, this is a big issue in Prague. Can I end by putting to you a comment from the Prague Pub Crawl Group, which organizes some of these events that you've been talking about? They say that really this is a failure of the city's management because you don't have enough police officers on the streets of Prague in the evenings to tackle some of the problems that are there, that it's not their fault. It's basically lack of resources.
Well, it's them who are providing the services. So maybe they could also take up some responsibility for their clients. I think this comment is really absurd.
There we go. Strong words there from Adam Zabransky. We did get a statement from the Prague Pub Crawl team. They said Prague City Hall has made a mistake, not realizing that without our Prague Pub Crawl, the mess and the noise will actually increase tenfold. Next week here on World Business Report, we're going to be looking at those BRICS economies. They contribute about 40% of the world's population, growing percentage of the world's economic growth as well. That's it from World Business Report.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast, and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.